Have you ever had a feeling that something dreadful was about to happen?
This whole premise is sweaty.
Okay, moving right along.
You gonna plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter?
Just remember that this thing isn't as black as it appears.
Hold on to your butt.
The only difference between me and a homeless man is his job.
I'm glad you're here to tell us.
I'm looking for the least possible amount of responsibility.
And that ain't bad.
I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Man's got to know his limitations.
I'm glad you came back.
In the bag.
Network.
I drink it up.
Welcome to the Bag Pod, everyone. Today, all we have is Alan and Jimmy TV.
What up?
Bags.
Nice. That was... All right, we're done.
Sorry, I had done. Something. I had
And now we're rolling.
Yeah. Joe Dog, I guess, is at work or taking care of his kid or something. I don't know what he's doing, but...
He's taking care of his kid at work.
Maybe. He's got responsibilities that some of us do not have, so he will not be attending this podcast. We'll try to get this podcast to be a little shorter than the usual, hopefully subtracting one person from the pod will make it shorter, but who knows. But yeah, let's hop right into Game of Thrones here. We discussed last week the final scene of last week's episode, the shadow birthing. I was glad that they did not make us wait throughout the episode until the shadow came out. And did what it needed to do. So, Alan, I would like to get your take on this whole shadow thing, since both Jake and I knew it was coming.
I thought it was awesome. I remember in that moment before it entered the room and ruined any chance of peace, I remember thinking, like, when I watch TV, it's like I'm like a kid. I'm like sitting here being like, I really hope that they can work this out. So when Remy was like, you know, maybe we can come to this understanding with my brother, I'm like, oh, good. I don't want them to fight. I don't want anyone else to get hurt. Mm-hmm. of course, then it came in and destroyed everything.
Yeah, no, the shadow
not did it. Not a great show for you to be watching.
Yeah, I think I'm starting to realize that.
Things do not tend to work out in the world of Westeros, unfortunately.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
What the shadow graphics... I mean, they looked better, I thought, last episode. This episode, they just seemed sort of... They might have just focused in on the shadow a little too long. Like, basically, when Brienne looks at Renly, right as the shadow's about to stab him, like, I feel almost as if that shot was a little too long, and it really kind of showed... They weren't shitty, but they weren't great graphics, you know?
Bags, you know what I think they were trying to do is really show that it was... really try to give it the look of Stannis. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to see if it looks like Stannis, I think you can kind of tell. Otherwise, I don't think you'd have any idea of it. So I think they kind of blew that, like you're saying. They didn't quite linger on it long enough to make you really know that that's Stannis, you know, like the shadow of Stannis.
But they lingered on it too long.
But they lingered on it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They should have just gone one way or the other and let it be that.
And honestly, I mean, was it that bad? I mean, if you were to compare it to a movie, I would say definitely yes, there wasn't, like, great graphics. But as far as what we've seen on television, I feel like they've put a lot of money into their CGI on this show.
Yeah.
Way more than, you know, it looked better than, like, something you'd see on, I don't know, like, Charmed or something.
Okay.
Well, Chernobyl.
That's true. I mean, it was fairly consistent with the rest of the special effects that you get in Game of Thrones, I suppose.
No, I mean, I would agree with Alan on this and say that it was a little bit better just because it was a little bit more minimalist, especially this episode as opposed to last week's where they had it really solidify and kind of like congeal and almost kind of walk around. And this one, it was much more smoky monster. And
yeah.
So it didn't have to look quite as neat, quite as clean.
Yeah, I mean, maybe... For me, I just feel as though it would have been nicer if they didn't focus so much time on it, because it was more. It seemed more menacing in the book, where like no one really knew what the fuck it was.
Yeah, Bags. I could
hear it was. It was.
I completely agree. And my impression in the book was almost like when it happened that they didn't even see it, anything happen until it had already happened, and then right when it happened, they kind of somewhat noticed this kind of little off shadow, and as quick as they saw it, it was gone. Like, I thought it was this real, like, sudden, quick, hitting kind of thing, but obviously they did not go with that in the show.
Exactly.
But do you want to confuse an audience that doesn't know
story,
you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is much in line with what they've been doing. In the first season, you know, they were really not being subtle with a lot of things that they are more so in the book. So, I mean, I think that's definitely in line with what they've been doing, and it makes sense. But it was just a little bit different than I had imagined it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ending of the last episode was her giving birth to a shadow. So I feel like it wouldn't have confused viewers that much.
That's gonna shatter stuff right there.
Yeah. So I mean, if a random shadow, sort of smoky looking shadow thing, just blows into the tent and slits someone's throat, I'm going to assume that most people are going to be like, "Oh, so that's what came out of her uterus last night."
I completely agree with you that that's what I would have taken from it. I've long since given up this battle that shows like this with an ongoing story, they always cater to those people who like don't really pay attention or don't like. There's so many people, like, I feel like there's so many girls, not to like pick on girls, but you know, there's some that
they,
you know,
are the weaker sex, Alan.
I remember from, you know, Lost days, like if something isn't spelled out specifically, a lot of, you know, people are just kind of like, wait, what? Who? What happened? And, you know, so I agree with you that I would have picked up on it if it was more subtle, but I think a lot of people, maybe, I don't know, some of their audience would have maybe been a little, like, confused or frustrated because it wasn't made clear enough.
Fair enough. Fair. To go along with this point, though, the next two scenes, the end of that scene where Caitlin, or Catelyn, I guess they call her, I don't know why, Catelyn and Brienne are talking, and then the scene right after that with the two Tyrells are talking, they're basically the exact same scene. They really beat us over the head with the whole someone's going to be taking some revenge. Someone needs to take revenge on Renly's death. So I was a little disappointed with that. Although Brienne was definitely a badass, killing all those random guards. Just I guess
a couple guards, yeah.
So
I like this pairing of the two of them being together now. She's like, you got like a very much of a mother character and another woman who's like very masculine, and they like kind of met in the middle with this like servant master relationship that they just kind of decided that they would have.
Mm-hmm. I would agree that they've got a pretty good relationship going in the books, throughout the books as well. So it should be interesting to see how they sort of grow with that. I really enjoyed their scene in the woods, even though it was a little hackneyed. I still thought it was pretty good when Brienne, where we really get Brienne doing everything like by the book and doing this whole vow thing, which is a huge deal to her. So I think they did a pretty good job with that scene later on in the show.
Yeah, whenever
she swears her fealty to
Catelyn. Yeah, whenever they've done any scene like that, obviously going back to the first season with the King of the North, it always just comes off so cheesy. If that ever actually happened, it couldn't have been that, like, you know, it couldn't have been like that. It could have been that campy.
Yeah. You would hope not, at least. You would hope not. Speaking of the other Tyrell scene, we got some more growling Carchetti. He's back. He's back in full force.
I noticed it finally. I was like, wait, his voice is different. This is what these guys are talking about.
It's better when he has multiple scenes in an episode, because he obviously does do something different every day that he films. Like, he obviously has a different approach to what he's saying every single different scene that he's in. So it's great when you can see, like, the one scene then come back 10 minutes later and see him doing something else, because he will just go for the ultra deep growl, kind of indistinguishable thing, and then it will come back really light with his Irish accent sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he's all over the place.
Carchetti needs either some better direction or just some better acting.
Yeah.
But yeah, that scene as well, the end of that scene with the Tyrells there, we get some more Margaery, and she seems, I mean, again, this is another thing that's hinted throughout the books, but we never are explicitly told what Margaery's aims and goals are. But she clearly states that she just comes out and she's like, I want to be the queen.
Yeah,
the queen.
This is obviously going back to what we were just saying with the subtlety of the show, and there's something else in the episode where it kind of happens too. But yeah, I mean, she could have just as easily been like, you know, no, I don't want to be just any queen. You know, she could have just said that and kind of maybe gave him like a lingering look, and we would have got it. Like that, people should know that means that she wants to be the motherfucking queen, not just any random person.
Well, not only that, but she also, I mean, she also clearly didn't care at all about Renly's death.
Right.
Whereas Loras is crying like a little bitch at his bedside, Marjorie there is just pacing around back and forth. So I feel like, again, with the subtlety, I think most viewers would have gotten it, but who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, we also got a bunch of North of the Wall scenes this week, which was nice, as we didn't have much Jon Snow. We didn't have much North in general. I mean, we had the Craster's Keep stuff, but that never really felt like the North. And this week, they're at the Fist.
They got to the Fist, which I always imagined to be a lot smaller. I always thought it was just like kind of like the Greenbrier Hill, you know, like just like a 30-foot elevation, you know, at best. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like round thing that they kind of fortified. But, I mean, they're up on a fucking plateau,
right,
man.
There,
yeah, they're I can see why people wouldn't be trying to take that over anytime soon. But the great thing about the show is at least in the above the wall scenes, is the scenery is amazing. Like when they were at the Fist and you could just see out and just know that like that's legit. That's actually how it is. That was fantastic.
That's legit.
I feel like this is the largest scale television show I've ever seen. At least in America, that they are really, at least this season, taking these crews to all these different locations in Europe and all over the world to just like get these really great visuals. It totally just immerses you in the show.
I mean, especially in the second scene when they're kind of looking in the distance, maybe, but it's snowing. Like I'm pretty sure that was just like actual snow. Like I don't think they were faking around with that.
They weren't on some back lot in Hollywood. There, that was definitely some Iceland. So, but yeah, going back to the Fist for a second, I always kind of imagined it as being that one place in Fellowship of the Ring where Aragorn and the Hobbits kind of stay. That one.
Yes. Day. Wintervane or something like that.
Yeah,
Weathervane.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much the same as what you would say. What you thought?
Oh, Winterfresh.
Yeah, that was the one.
Winterfresh.
So minty and delicious.
I'm pretty sure it's Weathervane. I'm gonna make it look up right now.
I think you're wrong. I think it's Winterfresh.
But it was the North scenes were great. Sam was much less scared as he's portrayed to be in the books and more just annoying, I suppose.
More like a 12-year-old girl.
He seemed cheery,
kind of emotional.
I mean, he is. It's weird. He seems excited almost, as opposed to scared.
Shit in his pants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know what exactly they're going for here. Maybe they're gonna bring him down again now that John is gone and his best friend is gone. But I'm not quite sure.
Well, they're obviously just building up him and Gilly's relationship.
Yeah, they are.
So something that I enjoyed is whenever I've read Dolores Ed Pollitt's lines in the book, she's always been like really punny, you know, like really terrible, terrible joke man. Uh-huh. And in the show, he's legitimately funny, which I'm really enjoying.
That's good.
He kind of has like a Robert Carlyle thing going.
All right.
Alan,
you have something to say?
No, I agree with that. I kind of see that vibe from him.
Okay.
Kind of felt like Daniel Craig-ish. To me, out of the looks that he gives people.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
They also introduced a new character, Corrin Halfhand, who is a badass.
And we didn't see his halfhand.
No, we did not see his halfhand, but he's a badass nonetheless.
Wait, which character are we talking about?
The guy that takes Jon Snow off at the end.
Oh,
where Jon's like, I want to go with you. And
yeah.
Yeah. But Korn,
he calls him Lord Korn at one point, and they all get a big laugh out of it.
Yeah, they get quite a nice little chortle on that one.
You're no ranger.
Exactly. So, but yeah, Korn, they set him up a little bit. They had one of the walking scenes, they were setting him up a little bit, and then Korn came in, and I'm pretty excited to see what Korn does here in these next couple episodes. I don't know how long they're going to stay within book two, because they seem to be kind of rushing through it, at least above the north of the wall here.
Well, I mean, I was kind of thinking about that too, just kind of the pacing in relation to the second book, like, you know, how they were covering the second book so far, mm-hmm. because it seemed like they didn't make a big deal about going into the third book for any number of characters. But honestly, they haven't really gotten that close, and I think you're right. I think north of the wall is kind of where they're certainly getting the closest, and I think this might even be where the second book ended for them. Right, because I'm not sure if they got to that crew, that first group of wildlings in the second book. Did they?
They did. They got to the lookout crew, and then you know what happens.
Yeah,
and then it ended right there. So they got there, but I mean, that's not. I mean, the way they're going.
That's the next scene. That's the next scene up north. Yeah,
you'll see them climbing a mountain, and then the very next scene after that, it all goes down. So
yeah, definitely.
So I guess the North will definitely benefit more from the third book than anything else. I mean, it seems also that within King's Landing, things are going much slower than they should be, at least in relation to some of the other. I mean, I guess everything else is kind of on pace, but the North really, the north of the wall scenes really are just like speeding through, so.
I thought we would have gotten a little bit more action in King's Landing at this point. Not to take away from anything they've been doing, but I was also surprised that they haven't gotten to some of the bigger stuff yet in King's Landing.
I mean, there's one part that where Tyrion is just endlessly building this chain.
Yeah, and we haven't even seen... Did he do that in the first episode?
I don't even think he meant... I don't think he's even mentioned it, and I mean, that's... basically something he mentions in the first in his
like as soon as he gets book. There as soon as he like takes his first step in King's Landing, he starts talking about this chain.
Yeah, so I don't know if they're just not putting that in or if we're about to get it or what, but I don't know, we'll see what happens there.
I think that's going to be kind of a subtlety thing where if they said it in the first couple episodes and then kind of left it alone,
mm-hmm.
they might be worried that America would get confused by it, so we probably won't get it until, you know, right where we see what it's all about.
So they're going to start building that chain next episode, and then at the beginning of the seventh episode, that shit's going to be done.
Exactly, and in use. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of King's Landing stuff this week. There was some Tyrion stuff.
We had that first scene with Tyrion and Cersei, and then as Tyrion's leaving, we get the obligatory Lena Headey head tilt and eye move that she does.
Yeah, no, it seems as though Cersei gets dumber and dumber by the week. She does not, she at least seems to know a little bit what's going on more in the book, whereas here, it doesn't even seem like she cares. Like, she's just doing, like, she can't see anything in the future, basically. She's just seeing one move ahead. And right. it's kind of annoying me. I mean, she's kind of like that in the book, but she at least kind of has a general understanding of the bigger picture. Whereas here, she's just doing one thing and then letting it go.
Or at least like kind of likes to think that she has an understanding.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, like so far she seemingly has put little to no thought into it. Whereas in the book, she does put thought into it, just does the wrong thing.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I personally, from my vantage point of just watching the show, I like that there's a difference in certain characters, the way they view the situation, because I think it's very real when it comes to politics, that there are some people on this show who think that, oh, now this is this situation, we overthrew the king is dead, we got the power, that's it, it'll just be like this. You know, forever. And you know, that's like that short-sighted mentality that I think a lot of politicians have and a lot of people in power have. But there are other people on the show who see that this is just another phase, that, you know, this can't last forever, that there's trouble coming. Winter is coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes for an interesting landscape of personalities when you have people who don't get that this isn't the end of the story.
That's true. That's true. They, what else did we have in King's Landing? We had Tyrion fun of in the streets, which I thought was a pretty good scene.
Yeah, where he was a mutant monkey head or whatever. We had the scene with him and Lancel where Tyrion's in like his little mini litter thing. Just chilling on the ground. That was so weird.
How did Lancel even fit in there?
Yeah, exactly. There's so much that was so weird about that.
Yeah, and then he also saw the stockpiles of wildfire in the ceramic pots.
Yeah.
Which
and we had a lot of Bronn lines in that scene too, which I thought was a little surprising.
Yeah, no, we got a lot of Bronn this week. Randomly.
Yeah.
So maybe they're setting up his character a little bit more, or they just need Tyrion to play off of someone. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, no. While there were a good amount of King's Landing scenes, none of them really felt as though they carried much weight this week, unfortunately. So.
No, yeah, none of them really resonated that much.
I liked them discovering the room of, I guess, Westeros' version of napalm.
The wildfire.
I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it felt like another modern warfare little like allegory. The way Tyrion's reaction to the room of this. There is enough power in this room to destroy King's Landing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like as if he was looking at the nuclear stockpile, there's like this menace to the way he reacted to it that I really liked.
When we got a lot of backstory, right, Batman? Isn't that where we got because they didn't.
In the show or the book?
In the book.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of backstory in the book about, like, wildfire.
On the wildfire and why. The
Alchemist Guild and all that sort
of stuff. And why there was so much of it in King's Landing and stuff like that. And a lot of that adds to just how great the books are in general and how they can't quite capture it in the TV show because obviously they're hurting for time. But
yeah,
you're definitely, it definitely plays a role moving forward.
Yeah, there is a lot there and there will be even more.
Yep.
It was good, too, that Tyrion kind of realized, you said it, that he realized, like, how much weaponry of this wildfire there was, and he realized that Cersei cannot be in charge of it.
Yeah.
So he made sure to tell the alchemist guy or whatever that he was now in charge of all the wildfire.
The alchemist guy was good. He had a couple pretty choice lines.
Yeah, he did.
The first one was Tyrion says something about pissing on wildfire and it burning his cock off, and the guy goes, "I have not tried that experiment yet."
Yes, that was a real choice.
Yeah.
However, another Lannister, Tywin Lannister, and with Arya in tow, were definitely the best scenes of the episode, I thought.
Yeah.
All of the Arya scenes this episode were really, really good.
Sunday night TV, it was all about the little girls, Arya and Sally Draper.
As I guess we'll get so. To. Yeah, we will definitely mention Sally a little bit later. But
I loved the scene between Arya and Grandpa Lannister, whatever his name is.
Tywin.
The way they framed them looking into each other's eyes that way, and her line of, anyone could be killed. And he's just kind of staring at him with that look. I loved that.
Yeah, and it was great, too, to see her not back down.
Even, yeah.
I mean, she knows that she has to keep herself alive, but she's also not going to back down. And it was just, I mean, I thought that scene in particular was just really, really awesome.
It was certainly an incredible scene and very well acted.
I like that actor a lot, too. The guy,
Charles Dance. Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, he brings it.
It bothered me a little bit actually. It was really good and it was really emotional and it was far and away the best scene I would say of the episode. But for Tywin, I mean they come right out right at the start of the scene. You're seeing how smart Tywin is and he might they're making it seem like he might be the smartest cleverest guy in Westeros almost like
mm-hmm.
He knows exactly what's going on he's really trying to think of how they can get the tide going in his favor and then all of a sudden his cupbearer is being insolent talking about anyone can die and staring into his eyes for like you know, just sitting there staring and on and on and on. Like, why wouldn't he be like, you know, what the fuck is going on? Like, what are you doing? Like, why wouldn't he just kill her?
He doesn't know. That moment was for us. That, I mean, if there wasn't a camera focusing in on people's faces, like, it's just a long pause, and like the studying each other's faces was for the audience.
You're it saying it happened much quicker than they showed it.
Yeah.
Okay. My other big gripe about it is that scene actually that scene does happen in the book, but with Roose Bolton, right, Bex?
Yeah, I don't remember her.
I'm not sure if she was ever even Tywin's cupbearer in the book. She was Roose's.
She was for a second, I thought, but then Roose immediately came in.
Well, the thing that I liked in this other scene, in the book scene, I mean, it could have just as easily been with Tywin, I guess, is when she keeps saying, my lord, you know, it's really formal instead of muddling it together, saying, my lord, mm-hmm. I thought that if we'd gotten a little bit of that, I would have been happy.
Okay.
Well, I mean, me saying that, I mean, Tywin recognizing her as being someone who's highborn, because she obviously is with her mannerisms and speech. So, like, you know, why wouldn't he be able to pick up on that?
True. We also, right after that scene, we got Arya going down to the water barrel?
I guess they have a pump or like a well. I mean, that's got to be what it is, right? Yeah.
To get Tywin some water since they're going to be up late that night working.
Yeah, all nighter.
And we get the return of pretty boy Jaqen.
Jaqen Khar. Mm-hmm. His guy's multicolored hair now.
He does. Yeah. I'm still
a man streaks his hair.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, that was I thought that scene was – I mean, that was definitely more taken straight from the book. It wasn't nearly as powerful or as good a scene as the one before, but it was good to see that we started that storyline as well in this episode. So, I don't know, what did we? I thought he was a little better than in the first time we saw him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the immediate shock of the way he talks and stuff like that. What was a lot better in that scene. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't come across as being really, really weird or odd and not quite right.
Yeah. And the look he gives Arya after he's killed the Tickler is, it's priceless.
Yeah. And
anyone who has a nickname, the Tickler, should be murdered.
they really jacked up his neck. Really, really jacked up his neck.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing looked like it was damn near separated off his body. Now the Tickler actually comes back up into the books in the latter part of Storm of Swords. It's not an inconsequential part, so it will be interesting to see how they handle that moving forward. Because mm-hmm. They obviously wanted a death that would resonate, and I think in the book it was. Someone who worked in the kitchens with Arya or something. Like, it was, you know, someone really, really inconsequential. So obviously they wouldn't have that in the book, but
yeah, it was like the show, person that was in charge of her or something.
Yeah. It's kind of all the slaves.
I'm hoping we'll get some internal conflict with her at least, where she's trying to decide who to kill, because that's kind of a big part that's a big chunk in the book there, and she does have some choices as to who she can kill. So I'm hoping that it won't just be her listing off another two people and then, you know, having that done. I hope we actually get to see her trying to decide who it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was a pretty big part in the book, and it helps develop her character as well.
Yeah.
But we've got a couple more places to go, I guess, across some seas.
Westeros, yeah, and Karth.
Yeah, let's just talk Theon here. His brief.
Oh yeah, yeah.
What is going on? Who was that guy? First off, clearly he's still not getting any respect. Probably. Well,
why is he trying? Why is he still like strutting around so much? Like, has he really not gotten it through his fucking head that's not how you go about it?
Well, he's Theon. He's not smart.
Yeah, no, see, I think he is kind of, I think he's a little smart. I mean, just certainly prideful in the books, but he's not dumb.
No, he's not dumb. I mean, I don't.
He,
I don't.
when I was watching that scene, he should have murdered that guy that stepped to him the second.
Oh my God, he should have punched. I mean, he should have done something. That's the only way he's
going to get that crew's respect. He should have
just
murdered.
And I did kind of expect them to do it too, because he is an a-hole. I mean, he's certainly an ass. So I'm actually a little surprised he did it.
Yeah.
Try to at least, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't. He just took it like a little bitch.
Yeah.
And then Yara came up out of nowhere for some reason. I guess just to continue the whole brother-sister rivalry thing, but
yeah, she keep flinging shit in his face.
Yeah, she really didn't need to be there. And then who was this guy that took him on the boat?
All right, that's supposed to be Dagmar Clefjaw.
Oh, awesome hoodie guy?
Yes.
He's just like, I'll take you over there. It's his first hand or whatever.
It's his first mate, and I would say they're obviously trying to make him like a Bronn to Theon, Theon's Tyrion. But in the books, he's this elderly, revered like first lieutenant, like in the Iron Islands. Like he's known. But Theon remembers him from when he was a kid. Like it's supposed to be someone who Balon Greyjoy knows that Theon's not going to be able to order this boat around by himself. So he puts Dagmar on this boat with him, so that his crew would actually like listen to what they were doing and stuff like that. That kind of pissed me off. Not so much that. I don't know. That kind of pissed me off.
I mean, that guy
seemed... But that was Dagmar.
Yeah, that guy seemed to be shady. As opposed to, like, holding clout and stuff.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that was definitely kind of disappointing. But hopefully, maybe he'll become a bit more of a leader badass as time goes on. I don't know. But, yeah, that guy definitely just seemed to be... He almost seemed to be like a devil whispering on Theon's shoulder or something. He's like, "Hey, I've got a plan right here."
Exactly. Yeah, it was real shady. This is going to be actually a great test of is the series being too subtle or not. At the end of that scene, Theon says, "You know, it'll be close to Torrhen Square, which is a place, you know, a castle up in the north, and we could take that easily, but we couldn't be able to hold it because Winterfell would send their troops." And it kind of goes dots off a little bit.
There was look there.
So, yeah, well, this is one of the times they're choosing to be a little bit more subtle about it. Alan, what do you think is going to happen next time we see Theon?
I have no idea. I really don't have, like, any read on that situation or where it's going. I just want him to be careful with those fishermen's nets.
Right, exactly. And yeah, see, I mean, as someone who's read the books and knows what's coming, obviously I look for the subtlety a little bit more. So I don't like criticizing the show for being, for banging us over the head with stuff necessarily, just because I know it's coming. So it always feels like it's being, you know, knocked over my head and, you know, I can't appreciate it sometimes. So
yeah,
that's all.
Yeah, no, I would agree to a certain extent. And they also kind of hammered that home a little bit too with the Bran scene later on, where he says, he does a very good thing. I thought his decision was logical. He says, "We'll send out all of our troops to Torrhen Square to, you know, to fight off the Iron Islands people or whatever." Mm-hmm. But
no, yeah, he did. I mean, that was definitely the right move.
But yeah, they kind of brought that whole sort of thing back, maybe giving you some more puzzle pieces to what might possibly happen.
Indeed. And I know my brother's probably going to talk about this in the comments, so I'm just going to go ahead and mention it, is that Bran's hair is ridiculous. And I think I figured out why. It's because he has bangs. Like, he has, like, layered bangs for some reason.
Yeah.
They should have... What? No one's cutting his hair like that.
He's just looking real weird all the time. He's gawky and awkward, and it's just crazy.
He's in the wrong... That haircut's in the wrong century.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, one other place to
Wait, what century?
I don't know, but not the one that they're in.
Not the Game of Thrones.
It's Spanish. It's a different planet. You can't like decide like, oh, this wrong century of style for this planet.
No one else has that haircut.
You don't know what goes on over there. It's probably it's a magic haircut.
I bet that was one of the first. I'll bet that was how the first men styled their hair. It's just really retro and old fashioned. That's probably what it is.
One other point to make with Bran here is I would have figured by now, unless I've gotten my book chronologically mixed up, that he would have been introduced to Mira and Jojen Reed by now.
They never cast the Reeds, so the Reeds are not going to unless they make like a kind of how Jaqen was in the first season. You're not going to see him in this season. And also, I guess I'm not sure if they cast him or not, but we haven't seen Big and Little Walder yet either.
That's true. I mean, at least with the Reeds, they're like an integral central part of the story of Bran's storyline. So you'd assume they would have them sometime. Exactly. So I don't know what they're doing with that. I mean, it seemed like Osha there is going to be a Reed replacement almost because.
I would completely agree with you. It definitely seems like that's the direction they're heading in how much he confides with her and vice versa and her kind of her knowledge of things north of the wall. So it's a little worrisome, I would say. I could care less about Jojen Reed, the younger boy, but Mira Reed. These are two characters in the book who are Bran's age. Actually, one's a little bit older, one's a little bit younger, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, come on, Mira, we gotta have Bran have a little honey kind of going on, right?
Yeah, exactly. Plus Mira, I mean, Mira is basically kind of his protector through the books as well. So.
Yep, with her trident and net or whatever.
But, yeah, in any case, one last place to go in Westeros here, or I guess away from Westeros, would be Karth.
Essos.
Where Dany actually got something to do, finally. Instead of wandering aimlessly through deserts.
A little something?
Yeah, we get to see her flirted up with a very big Zero. Zoan Daxos.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. The first thing we see is her telling the dragon to light that meat on fire.
Yeah.
And she's not looking through it or over it or past it or anything like that. So however, I mean, I think it might have been more of a case of how they framed it, but it definitely didn't look bad that time.
Yeah, no, that was pretty good. And then it looks like there's some dissension in the ranks of her slaves as well, which is something that definitely wasn't in any of the books that I can remember.
Not that they mentioned. Yeah, they certainly seem to have a little bit of beef going on there.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Dany partying it up a little bit at that swank pad in Karth.
They had a great conversation, or at least one of her only surviving, maybe her only surviving Blood Rider and Jorah were talking about how they were going to steal that goose, that golden goose.
Yes.
And cut it down and meld it and stuff like that. That was phenomenal.
Yeah, that was great.
Whenever they showed Jorah and he had that light blue scarf, like silk scarf on, I just lost it every time. Oh, man.
He was a pimp. What can you say?
He certainly got a little bit of flair going on there.
That he does. How about Pyat Pree? That guy was creepy as hell.
Indeed.
I mean, I don't have anything else to say other than he looked fucking creepy.
That was terrifying.
It was very terrifying. They mentioned the House of the Undying, which is going to be a future, a big scene in the future of and Dany, so that was nice. They made mention of it, yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, Zero definitely, Zero proposing to Dany as a power move as opposed to a love move, even though in the book, Zero is more of a beggar than a guy who seems to know. You know, he's at least trying to flatter her more than he does in the show.
He definitely, in the show, he definitely seems to be a little bit more set up and established than he does in the, yeah.
And then, of course, the very next scene with Dany, we have her and Jorah talking it up, which was, I thought, another real good scene there.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
What did I have to say about that scene? I don't know what I had to say about it, but it was good. I liked it. What do we got here? Jorah actually showing some emotion, which was nice, as opposed to him sort of like telling Dany what to do. He showed he was clearly invested. I liked the fact that we actually got to see more of what Jorah's thinking and wanting, as opposed to him just trying to be the straight-laced advisor, if you will.
And yeah, I mean, in the past, it seems like he's just always been the person who kind of says, you know, yeah, just kind of adds in one or two lines maybe for people who have read the books and just want, like, a little something more or something like that. You know, he's just kind of chipped things in here and there. So yeah. It's nice to see him actually be a real character and not just, you know, just some
just some
thing. Yeah.
Scenery guy. Yeah. It was nice too that it seems as though Danny is trusting Jorah more than she is of Zara, which is good.
It seemed like she realized that Zara was right, that he did have feelings for her in that scene.
That too. Definitely.
I was a little surprised that Jorah did not mention the fact that in the book they make this whole deal about how everyone is trying to be nice to Dany so that they'll get one of her dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to see Jorah not really bring that up.
That was curious that they didn't do that.
Because that's like a huge thing in the book. Like almost every Dany chapter had something where Jorah's like, no, he's only being nice to you because they want the dragon.
Yeah, don't let him touch your dragons. Don't let him touch your goodies.
or like, the dragon is priceless. You deserve more for a dragon than this. So
definitely. It's
interesting to see how they didn't kind of play that up. But, yeah, I think other than that, that's going to do it for this week on Game of Thrones. Jimmy TV, do you have anything to say before you peace out?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we wrapped it up pretty nicely. The last two things that I made note of, and one of them we already talked about, was, literally, you know, this is the last 90 seconds of the show. Mm-hmm. We had to get Gendry without a shirt on, because God forbid we don't see someone's chest during an episode of Game of Thrones.
And then we had,
yeah, he was super ripped. He must have gotten real loaded on some wine before that scene. and then the Tickler got his like head twisted off and, you know, killed. And God forbid we don't see a little bit of violence in an episode of Game of Thrones. So they certainly just kind of had to jam those in there to fill their quota.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah. One last thing I'd like to mention was they had some more direwolf in there, and I thought it was good because it was just far away, and ghost at the, on top of the fist there was just kind of presiding over everything and looking over everything. I thought that was pretty cool.
That really was awesome. Just having ghost there randomly, kind of just chilling on top of a pile, looking around. That was cool.
Yeah, that was definitely cool. But yeah, no, we'll send Jimmy TV off over to Carth, I suppose, or somewhere across the Narrow Sea. And we will bring him back next week for some more Game of Thrones talk.
Oh, hopefully a little bit sooner than that, right, Abex? Talk a little bit about hockey, a little BSG, hopefully here in the next week.
One can hope, yes. A little community as well, so.
Cool.
But Jimmy TV, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, I'll see you boys later.
Safe travels.
All right, peace.
All right, let's move on to something more grounded in our real world. 60s New York, Mad Men. This week's episode seemed to be more of a breather, almost, something that allowed us to catch our breath, more so than the last two episodes where it seemed like they were very intent and were pushing, progressing the story further and further, and this episode seemed to be more of a just, I mean, I'm not going to say it didn't have anything to do with what was going on, but it just sort of reinforced some of the themes from earlier episodes.
Yeah, it was this is like a classic Mad Men episode. A party and a lot on the line. Mm-hmm. They had a lot going on at stake, and then someone having a realization or a coming of age story like we had with Sally.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoyed it, actually. I thought there were some really great scenes.
Oh no, there were some great scenes. Maybe the funniest line in the history of television was uttered. We'll get to that a little later. But yeah, no, unless they're going to make the Hines account a huge deal, you know, maybe make it as big as Lucky Strike was in thematically and story-wise as it was in last season, I don't think there's going to be too much taken from this that's going to affect further the season down the road. Except for the last, like, minute where we see Megan talking to her dad.
Well, Hines, I think, I mean, I don't know where the story's going to go, obviously, but I think that, you know, Hines could be the new Lucky Strike, as you just suggested, because Hines is a big company.
Oh, yeah, Hines is much bigger than Lucky Strike, yeah.
Yeah, they make a shitload of things. I don't know about what they're doing at that time, you know, in the late 60s, but they, as we know, that they eventually become a big, Enterprise. But yeah, the Hines has, you know, just been like a tool for us to watch. You know, we had a lot of great Peggy story out of the Hines account, and then now Megan and Don having their glory moment with that account.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. This episode, we've had a lot of changes throughout this season. We've got Roger back now, a happy Roger. A Roger that's willing to try again, and he's got his fingerprints all over this episode.
Yeah.
But perhaps, well, maybe we should talk about the return of another character who, for some odd reason, I didn't think would ever come back, but he's back, and that would be Mr. Glenn.
Yeah, I feel like we were just talking about that a couple weeks ago. He came back.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, he's somewhat integral to Sally's storyline, but
I don't want to be cynical about it, but he is Matthew Weiner's son.
I'm aware, so it
could very well, like, obviously they're not gonna, you know, ruin the story just to put him in, but I think that there's a lot of
Well, I mean, what do you think he exactly added to this week's episode besides us getting some more Sally?
Yeah, no, I think he was just something for us to have Sally. He's a confidant of Sally's because she doesn't have very many. And every, you know, she has an interesting story because she keeps finding people to be close with, and then they die or they move away or
they get divorced or.
Or they ruin her childhood.
Yeah.
As we saw in this episode.
Yeah, no. I mean, Glenn is definitely seems to be more of something that Sally gets to play off of as opposed to his own character, which he kind of had been in previous episodes. But I still get the feeling that Glenn is going to end up coming back in later seasons as some sort of weird serial killer, like a Charles Manson type or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't be. Yeah, he'll end up in the Manson family. That's correct.
Yeah, because he's just really creepy.
Yeah. You know?
But yeah, no, this was, I guess Sally gets sort of one episode a year. I'd say this is probably Sally's big episode, her coming out, if you will.
Yeah, she's a cast member, so I think, you know, that I see them more and more trying to insert her
into
stories.
But yeah, no, this was definitely her sort of coming out and her sort of, her realization that being an adult sucks and or being an adult from the non-60s sucks.
I'm really curious how the events of this episode are going to affect her. That I think I'm going to, if I had to guess, I feel like we're going to see her not opening up to any male characters anytime soon again. Mm-hmm. I feel like she keeps feeling like she was betrayed by them.
I
feel like that was kind of what was going on with her. In Roger, who up until that moment was such a great, those are really awesome two characters to put together.
Yeah.
In a scene.
They were really good together. Roger, who's got this wealth of experience, it was almost a microcosm of how all of the adults' relationships are. You know, compacted into like a series of scenes.
Sure.
They're all happy. They pretend to be happy. You know, they're happy together. They're working. They're using. I mean, he was basically using Sally as most people do, use their wives. And then, you know, behind closed doors in a different room, the person that you think you know and or are enjoying their company are actually getting a blowjob from someone else. Even if Sally might be too young to understand really the sexual stuff, I'm not quite sure how old she's supposed to be. But yeah, it definitely was a microcosm for all of the marriages, all of the relationships in this show, really.
I feel like there's been, in the past couple seasons, a running theme of her being overly sexualized too early. Like, she keeps seeing things that she wasn't supposed to, sexual things, or
she gets caught masturbating at a
right
party,
right? Whatever. Like, well, I don't know about realistically too early, but at least as far as like any sort of modern sensibility that, you know, we see her doing these things way earlier than we would expect. At least a girl.
Yeah, especially in the '60s too.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we have that view of it, and it's interesting that they keep doing that. I'm waiting to see what the grand effect on her is going to be from all these experiences.
I have a feeling she's going to become a slut in a couple seasons. But we'll
yeah.
See. Or a lesbian.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Who knows?
Little women's lib going on over there.
Yeah.
She could
become friends with Peggy's photographer friend.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting relationship there, whereas like most of the other people in the office, they seem to be sort of stuck between the old ways of doing it and the sort of new ways of doing it. I'm not saying sex, I'm saying relationship stuff.
Right.
But it's just because Peggy is very much in sort of set in the old ways of doing things. Not necessarily like the religious way that her mom wanted, that her mom is so keen on, but just like, you know, she really is becoming one of these 50s admin in front of us. And it's interesting to see how Abe is sort of the new 60s guy, and they sort of have this clash going on. And Peggy always seems to have to choose between, do I stay grounded in the past ways of doing things, or am I going to continue to strive to improve in the future ways or the present ways of doing things? And so the whole move-in thing was her whole storyline in this episode was good because you could see how excited she was for the proposal, even though she felt that they were going to break up before Joan told her about the proposal. And then she sort of is disappointed when he's not asking her to marry him.
Yeah.
Which is very much like a 50s sort of, you know, the old woman sort of fantasy where you just do things to get married, and that's like the biggest achievement you can accomplish is being married.
Right.
But then when he asks to move in, you know, she basically chooses to continue along this sort of new way, 60s way of thinking. So it's always interesting to see what kind of choices she makes.
It's interesting also because I feel like that's all happening because we're seeing the seeds of the modern relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone else is kind of experiencing what we would expect at that time of, you know, older men, younger girls, men are in charge of the relationships, but from our point of view, Peggy is one of the first, she's like a trailblazer, like one of the first successful women that we get to watch.
Exactly.
And, you know, when she meets a guy who's just like a real artist by nature and he's overly sensitive, we're kind of seeing like that reversal.
That role reversal again.
Yeah.
Exactly. And even they had the scene in the beginning where Abe was eating, supper over at the office, and he was completely uncomfortable because she was basically just one of the guys. And, you know, I thought that was a good scene as well.
Yeah, it was. It was making him really uncomfortable, you could tell.
Mm-hmm. To continue along with the themes of the season, we get some more railing against marriage Calvay's visit to Don and Megan's pad there. Clearly they are not a happily married couple, and they are an older couple that have been together for a while too. So it seems as though basically it's going to be Don and Megan's marriage trying to hold up in like this onslaught of just unhappiness and people that should be divorced and stuff like that. It should be interesting again to see how that ends up, but I don't know. How do you feel about all that?
About Megan's parents?
Yeah, about the Megan's parents and just getting yet another couple thrown at us that are unhappy and, you know, kind of trying to portray that.
Yeah, you know, we keep seeing all these older people who they had one way of doing things, and it may or may not have worked for a while, but we keep seeing like the relationships and the dreams of older characters in the show kind of like falling away. And I think I guess the question now is, like, how are the younger characters going to react to that? Mm-hmm. How is, you know, we don't really know how it's going to affect Megan in the long run, that she has this dad who's like very anti-capitalist and her mom who's clearly got all these issues. You know, it's kind of one of those things, like, is it going to make her or break her? Is she going to fall into that trap of being in a similar relationship with Don, or is she going to try to use her parents as, you know, example of what not to be?
Well, it was interesting too to see, it was interesting too to see how they had that one line where Don was in bed with Megan, and Megan was like, "I'm sorry for my mom," and Don was like, "What are you talking about?" So it was interesting to see that Don seemingly has moved on from his debaucherous infidelity in the past, and where he didn't even realize that Megan's mom was flirting with him. Now, of course, it is his wife's mother, so maybe that kind of, maybe he just shut it off entirely because of that, but it was interesting to see that he didn't even realize that she was flirting with him.
Yeah, I agree, because Don has this, like, sixth sense that I don't even know if he is aware of, mm-hmm. of, like, he was a dog, but he was classy about it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There were times that, like, if he met, I don't know, there are certain characters that, like, he would know, there are certain people that he would meet that he would just instinctively know, I need to keep this separate.
Yeah.
I'm not going to hit on this person. As he grew more and more unhappy, that kind of like went away. But I feel like he's just so, I think he's really content right now. Mm-hmm. And it's part, you know, he looks at Megan's mom as someone, but the parents as someone he needs to impress and not put his penis in.
Very true. Very true. Speaking of penises, perhaps the greatest line I've heard in a television show in a while came from Megan's dad in this episode. And he said, if I'm not mistaken, he said that they were talking about right as Sally came out and she showed herself to, you know, everyone. And everyone was like, oh, my God, she's grown up. This is her coming out sort of thing. And Don's like, no makeup. And then Megan's dad comes up with the line, "One day your little girl will spread her legs and fly away."
I love the reaction from the room.
Yeah, on that line. Starts tripping. Megan and Don are just in awe. I didn't even really see Megan's dad's reaction. I don't know if it was, I mean, they had the line right after that was like, that's supposed to be spread their wings.
Yeah,
but I don't know if that was, I mean,
read on if he did that intentionally or not.
I mean, he's a writer, so we would think, but he's also French Canadian, so you don't know.
Yeah.
But you would think
you don't
would know the saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was just hilarious. That was, I uproariously guffawed.
I did too. Me and my roommate, we both like, kind of like squealed a little bit when he said that.
Yeah, no, that was great. But yeah, no, we get another scene later on, to go back to the Hines account, where we see Don and Megan actually working as a team. I guess we get a couple of these scenes. Megan comes in with a very 2001 A Space Odyssey sort of idea for Hines, where Hines is the staple throughout the ages.
Mm-hmm.
But weirdly enough, she wants Don to take credit for it. And it's not as if she's ashamed of the idea. She realizes it's good. But for some odd reason, and it's not like she doesn't think that, I mean, there maybe at the beginning there was a little bit of her saying, you know, they won't care about the idea as much if I tell them, you know, just because it's still really a very much man sort of world.
Yeah,
but it towards the end, it didn't, like, when her and Peggy had that discussion in the hallway, she was clearly not proud. She was not excited or happy or proud about what she came up with.
She seemed like afraid to fly in that whole situation, and we saw, you know, her dad's attitude towards what she's doing. I don't know if that played a part in it, but yeah, she really. I agree. I think she didn't want to take credit because in her view, she's still like, she's just a little girl and it's not her place to speak up about that sort of thing. Which was great because it set up such a great mm-hmm. scenario when she like kind of turned into the quarterback at the dinner with the Hines couple.
Exactly, but she turned in the quarterback, but she still handed the ball off to Don, too. She didn't spearhead the thing either. So, and I mean, clearly, you know, she called a play or whatever, but it still was making sure that Don was taking the credit. Even when Don is trying to say, like, oh, you know, Megan came up with this idea or something, she's like, no, you know, I only helped you or whatever, so.
But and now, like, I mean, it's part of the genius of the show. Like, I don't know how much Megan, the character, knows, but I thought it was interesting that we've seen already the Hines guy, he doesn't really take seriously. He seems to, any time a woman says something to him, he kind of takes it with a grain of salt. Even though, you know, Peggy wasn't at her best when she did her pitch, it was very clear that he was partially dismissing it because she was
a woman. Yeah.
So I don't exactly think it was a sign of weakness. I think it was intelligence or an insight that had Megan, you know, she easily could have pitched it herself, but I think it was an intelligence that she knew that this should come through Don. It should look like natural.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But when you couple the fact that she was not excited at all when they were celebrating and the conversation at the end of the episode – where her dad is basically saying, you know, this isn't what you wanted to do. I'm just sad because you've taken the easy way out or whatever. It makes you wonder a little bit to wonder why she didn't take more credit for the idea.
I think that this is a scary new thing for a girl. I mean, and she is a girl. She's very young in that time. You know, it was ridiculous what her dad was saying, because I don't know exactly what he was referring to, but as far as we know, she came to New York to be an actress. Mm-hmm. And for her dad to almost be acting like there is some something to be ashamed of in the fact that she stopped chasing something that is pretty much impossible, to the fact that she's doing actual work, that she's like creating something, like, I think he's wrong.
I think that was more pointed to the fact that she's married Don, and it's sort of like, I mean, this goes back to the whole relationship thing where, you know, in the 50s, it was all basically about making sure that you had exactly what you wanted and not maybe exactly what you wanted, but like living to these ideals of the perfect 50s family and all that sort of stuff, and everything else is just laying underneath. And so I feel as though he was saying, you know, you've settled for a good life instead of making your own way. And that's what he was saying. Because, you know, she married a much older man, Don, who was already well off, you know, which clearly, if you're going out with someone that's well off, you know, that'll probably make you work a little less towards making your own path. So that, I mean,
he was kind of
railing against the whole thing where it's like, you know, once you get what you need, you know, it doesn't work, basically, I feel like.
Yeah, I agree. That's what he was saying. But I think he was wrong. And everything that we've seen in Megan's behavior has shown that marrying Don hasn't done anything except, like, ignite her ambition further. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the guy is a communist. He doesn't like Don because he has money on top of it, you know, on top of the usual, like, you know,
the materialistic. I mean, he works in a materialistic business. Yeah.
So I don't know. I agree. I think that a lot of her father's point of view has made her a little insecure about what she wants. But I think that is what she wants. She wants to be something and not just Don's wife.
Well, I mean, it should be interesting to see, too. It seems as though we're going to get, just when we think Don and Megan are at a good place, it looks like that's going to be thrown upside down here with what her dad had to say and her general unhappiness to achieving success in this profession.
Yeah.
So
as I've said every week, I don't agree. But it definitely looks like that is a possibility. I have a very optimistic take on the relationship, but yeah, you're right. It could very possibly go that way because her dad is definitely a huge obstacle.
I mean, it just seems like, I'm not saying necessarily that it's going to end, but it looks like it's headed in a direction where Megan might have to choose between being happy with Don or being happier in a career path, some sort of thing like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably going to do it, unless you have anything else to say.
No, I thought it was a pretty interesting episode. It was a lot of funny scenes, and I was happy with it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought it was a pretty good episode as well. But yeah, no, I think that's going to do it for this podcast. Hopefully, as Jimmy TV alluded to earlier, we will have another television-esque sort of podcast coming out later this week, where at the very least we will discuss some of NBC's comedy community, as well as rehash some Battlestar Galactica. And then hopefully we'll be talking a little NHL and NBA playoffs as well on another podcast later this week. But as usual, you can come to the website, come check us out. We put up a lot of updates, mainly sports-related today, although Alan had a nice post where he's excited about all the movies coming out this year.
Woo!
Before we go, do you have any one movie you're most excited about from that grand list that you gave us today?
One?
Yeah, you only get to pick one, the one that you're most excited about.
If I was going to pick one movie to see this year, it would be The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay, Dark Knight Rises. It's probably
because I have to have the conclusion, and everything else feels newer.
You have to watch Batman die, which apparently is the mad speculation on every interweb site you can find.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, I would say that's probably a fair choice. It's always nice seeing Gary Oldman as Commissioner Jim Gordon. So, but yeah, no, come by the website in-the-bag2gs.com. There we just put up a whole slew of NFL draft stuff, so you can come check that out. There hopefully will be some Avengers stuff a little later on in the week as well. I believe our boy Alan and Jay Kringle, who's our movie guy who does the trailer article every week, have a Marvel movie marathon planned.
Cannot wait.
Up to a Midnight Avengers, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
So hopefully we'll be able to get some feedback on that from those guys. But yeah, come check us out, and we'll come to you guys a little later.